From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, the latest on the crisis in northern Iraq, the Gaza ceasefire, green lighting use of experimental Ebola drugs, plus the deaths of actor-comedian Robin Williams and movie star Lauren Bacall. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. U.S. Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel says about 130 more U.S. military advisors have been deployed to northern Iraq. They're there to assess ways in which Washington can help Baghdad deal with the resurgent Islamist extremist. Hagel also stressed that the deployment will not be a combat boots-on-the-ground operation. Also, an Iraqi helicopter carrying desperately needed aid to thousands of stranded Yazidi refugees fleeing Islamic extremists crashed, killing the pilot and injuring others aboard. The chopper had just delivered emergency aid packages and picked up some refugees when it went down. The cause of the crash is unknown. The international community is rushing to deliver aid to the thousands of ethnic minority Yazidis stranded without enough food and water on Mount Sinjar in northwestern Iraq. United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon on Tuesday spoke with reporters at the UN in New York about the situation in Iraq.
The people of Iraq and all of the Iraqi people need security, yet the poison of hatred and brutality is spreading. The so-called Islamic State, IS, is a threat to Iraq, Syria, and the region. I'm profoundly dismayed by its barbaric acts, including accounts of summary executions, boys forcibly taken from their homes to fight, girls abducted or trafficked as sex slaves. The plight of Yazidis and others on Mount Sinjar is especially harrowing.
European Union announced Tuesday that it's increasing humanitarian assistance to the Iraqis trapped by the fighting in their homeland, but pressure is mounting on Brussels to do more. We go to Paris now, and Lisa Bryant, who reports France and Italy are calling for an emergency EU meeting to consider providing military assistance to Kurds fighting Islamist extremists in Iraq.
European Humanitarian Commissioner Kristalina Georgieva says Brussels will provide an extra $6.7 million in humanitarian aid for people trapped by the latest jihadist offensive in northern Iraq. It brings the total EU humanitarian aid for Iraq this year to nearly $22.7 million.
The new funding is to help hundreds of thousands of vulnerable Iraqis, including minority groups, that have been besieged in the mountains of Sinjar. We will be providing emergency assistance to displaced populations, but also to very vulnerable host communities, poor communities that have to cope with this inflow of internally displaced people.
The new funds come as Washington remains prepared to carry out more airstrikes against Islamist State in Iraq and Syria militants who have laid siege on Mount Sinjar and threatened to advance on the Kurdish capital of Erbil. European Union representatives met Tuesday to discuss Iraq and other crisis-torn countries. France and Italy now want EU foreign ministers to return from their vacations for an emergency meeting to take those talks to a higher level. At issue, whether to help arm Kurdish soldiers fighting militants. Interviewed on France Info Radio, French Foreign Minister Laurent Fabius says there is a power imbalance between well-armed ISIS militants and what he called courageous but poorly equipped Kurdish soldiers. Iraq is one of several major emergencies, including Syria, Gaza, the Central African Republic, and South Sudan, that is testing the global humanitarian response. When it comes to Iraq, Commissioner Georgieva described immense challenges accessing desperate people in ISIS-controlled areas.
Spread of extremism around the world, not just in Iraq, has meant more and more restrictions to access. The world is walking backwards on its main achievement after the two world wars, which was respect for humanity, even in the worst of circumstances. Let help get to those who need it. And we must reverse this trend.
France and Britain have already airdropped food and humanitarian supplies to besieged people in northern Iraq. French Foreign Minister Fabius says another 20 tons of food is on its way. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
Skies over Gaza were quiet for a second day Tuesday in the midst of a 72-hour ceasefire, but Israeli negotiators reported no progress in their talks with the Palestinians in Cairo on a permanent end to fighting. The negotiators focused on Israel's blockade of Gaza, where Hamas militants running the area say they want a seaport open to promote economic development. Israel says it fears ending the blockade now would allow Hamas to restock weaponry from abroad, and that could be used against Israel if the fighting resumes. Israelis in communities close to the boundary with Gaza are trying to recover from the month-long conflict in which more than 3,000 rockets were fired into Israel. Some have returned home, but they say they still live in fear. VOA's Scott Bob reports now from a kibbutz about 2 kilometers from the Gaza border.
Workers at Kfar Aza repair a roof damaged by a rocket from Gaza. No one was hurt. Most families evacuated when the conflict started, leaving only a few to care for the place. This community of 800 people was hit 15 times during the recent conflict. One man, the head of a local college, was wounded coming home from work. He heard the warning but did not have time to take cover. Teacher Orit Sadikovich says when the siren sounds, she has almost no time to get her 4 children into the safe room.
In the middle of the night, there is an alarm, and I have 15 seconds, to run to a shelter place, to the safety room, which is built out of concrete, and I have to choose what children I'm going to take first.
Nearby Sderot has been hard hit since Hamas seized power in Gaza, as can be seen by the rockets on display at the police station. Many residents are angry with the government, says former mayor Eli Moyal.
Because somehow, somewhere, people in this place believing that probably the Israeli government cannot provide the security needed in here.
Meanwhile, back at Kfar Aza, workers continue the cleanup, this one from a mortar shell. Sadikovich was born in this community, founded by her parents more than 50 years ago. She has lived here all her life.
Now it's the first time in my all 43 years that I live here in this kibbutz that I am thinking about leaving the place.
She says this is the third war in 6 years and that her children are showing the effects of the constant stress.
We don't know, and it's very sad to live life like that. So even if you see there nobody got killed, we get killed inside. Every time, every alarm, every day that is not quiet. It's killing us.
Community leaders also worry that the kibbutz production of farm and plastic goods could be affected if the cycle of violence continues. Scott Bob, VOA News, Kfar Aza, Southern Israel.
Visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com. Online news for a changing world.
World Health Organization giving a green light for the use of unproven drugs to fight the deadly Ebola outbreak in 4 West African countries. We get more now from Lisa Schlein at WHO headquarters in Geneva.
There have been a number of Ebola outbreaks in Eastern and Central Africa over the past 40 years. The World Health Organization was able to stop those outbreaks by identifying and isolating all cases of the disease, tracing those who have come in contact with infected individuals, and providing protective covering to healthcare workers. But officials from the UN Health Agency acknowledge what has worked in the past is not working now. They say the outbreak in four West African countries, Guinea, Sierra Leone, Liberia, and Nigeria, continues to spread and appears to be unstoppable. Therefore, WHO Assistant Director General Marie-Paul Kini says the panel of experts who convened Monday unanimously agreed that it is ethical to offer unproven medicines as potential treatments.
The magnitude and the spread of the outbreak makes it that we don't have enough people to use and to rely only, if I may say, on what has traditionally worked if we want to stop the outbreak as quickly as possible. So this is why, in these particular circumstances, the ethicists have felt that it was ethical to propose these treatments and this vaccine, although they have not been registered yet.
West African health authorities report that more than 1,800 people have come down with Ebola and more than 1,000 have died. There is no cure for this disease, which can kill up to 90% of its victims and is spread through direct contact with the blood or bodily fluids of an infected person. Researchers have found some potential treatments and vaccines that could help bring Ebola under control. But while a handful of these drugs have shown positive results in monkeys, they have not been clinically tested in humans to see whether they are safe and effective. The health of two American aid workers who got infected with Ebola in Liberia has improved since they were treated with an experimental drug known as ZMapp. This has raised hopes of other successful treatments by using this and other unproven drugs. While the WHO has given the go-ahead for the use of untested treatments and vaccines, Dr. Kini says certain ethical criteria must guide their use. These include transparency of care, informed consent, freedom of choice, confidentiality, and community involvement.
The panel also emphasized that because we know so little about safety and efficacy in humans, whenever these treatments are provided for what we call compassionate use, which means as defined as access to an unapproved drug outside of a clinical trial, then there is a moral obligation to collect and share all data generated.
The World Health Organization says it will push for the speedy start of clinical trials for Ebola drugs that look promising. It notes that trials for two vaccine candidates might begin by the end of September. Were this to happen, it says information regarding their safety could be available by the end of the year. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon spoke with reporters Tuesday about the Ebola outbreak, which has overwhelmed the healthcare community in West Africa.
I urge the international community to respond urgently to the shortage of doctors, nurses, and equipment, including protective clothing and isolation tents. We need all hands on deck. Second, coordinated international response is essential. I remain in close touch with Dr. Margaret Chan, Director General of WHO. In the days ahead, the UN system will further strengthen the way we are dealing with the outbreak.
And at that Tuesday news conference, Mr. Ban said an organized global response is key to controlling the outbreak. He announced he has appointed UN public health expert David Nabarro to coordinate the United Nations efforts to fight Ebola. Well, that Ebola virus scare has gripped Cameroon following allegations that imported cases from neighboring Nigeria have been diagnosed. Cameroon's Minister of Health has refuted the allegations. World Health Organization says at least 10 cases of Ebola have been confirmed in Nigeria. Moki Edwin-Kinzika reports.
Rumors that cases of the deadly Ebola virus had been detected at the government referral hospital in Douala, Cameroon, spread like wildfire. 17-year-old student Marcel Frou told VOA that he was informed by the media of two Nigerians detected with the virus at the Douala airport and taken to the referral hospital.
J'ai écouté le journal de 20 heures à la télévision et on a annoncé qu'il y avait Ebola au Cameroun.
He says during the local television news, he received the information that there were already cases of Ebola carried by Nigerians into Cameroon. Nigerians throng into Cameroon on a daily basis for business, vacation, and fear of the militant group Boko Haram. Some clergy and traditional rulers took the message to their people, advising them to report other suspected cases. But Minister of Health Andre Mamafuda says the information about Nigerian Ebola victims in Cameroon was wrong.
With regard to our country, Cameroon, no suspected case has been reported till date. In preparation for a possible emergence of this disease, surveillance is strengthened in all the health districts on the borders, particularly at the level of health posts, airport, and seaports.
Mamafuda said since the World Health Organization declared Ebola an international public health emergency, they have been working with Nigeria to halt the spread of the disease.
The Democratic Republic of Congo has provided us with two Ebola kits comprising 100 protective clothing for medical staff.
24-year-old University of Yaoundé student Enanga Mercy says the Minister of Health's message at least sounded reassuring.
I felt very relieved because considering what I saw on the internet on how the disease eats up people, it's really scary and very, very demoralizing. So when I got the news, I was really happy. And besides, the government cannot lie to us because they will have to tell us if the disease is in the country so that we'll take measures to protect ourselves from it.
Cameroon has been explaining to its residents that there is no cure and no vaccine for Ebola, and it has a high fatality rate. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
From the ordinary to the extraordinary, you never know what in the world will happen next.
The world is watching with grave concern as Russia has positioned its
military. You should not allow anyone to deprive you of your right to determine the future.
We are using this against terrorist groups coming from Turkey.
The landing on
and sponsored by, no, we are not killing civilians.
This with all that's happening, VOA News works to keep you up to date every hour of every day. So when you want to know what's new, you know what to do. Tune in your radio or click on the internet. World News on the hour, every hour, or at your convenience at voanews.com.
Law enforcement authorities say American actor-comedian Robin Williams committed suicide by hanging himself at his California home. The local assistant deputy chief coroner, Lieutenant Keith Boyd, spoke with reporters Tuesday about 24 hours after Williams' body was discovered.
On August 11, 2014, at approximately 11:55 a.m., Marin County Communications received a 911 telephone call reporting that a male adult had been located unconscious and not breathing inside his residence located at 95 St. Thomas Way in unincorporated Tiburon, California. The caller was distraught and indicated at that time that was an apparent suicide due to a hanging had taken place and that rigor mortis had set in. The Sheriff's Office, as well as representatives of the Tiburon Fire Department and Southern Marin Fire Protection District, were dispatched to the incident with emergency personnel arriving on scene at 12 p.m. The male subject, who was pronounced deceased by firefighters from the Tiburon Fire Department at 12:02 p.m., has been identified as Robin McLaurin Williams.
63-year-old Williams was reportedly last seen alive at his home late Sunday. Statement from his publicist said Williams had been battling depression. His longtime struggle with drugs and alcohol also was widely known. Dr. Jay Singh is a Washington, D.C.-based expert on suicide, also a clinical associate at Yale School of Medicine. He specializes in treatment of depression and bipolar disorder. Dr. Singh told VOA it's very important to look at the positives coming out of Robin Williams' suicide.
I think there's a few positive points here. I think the one thing that it really does for us is it really humanizes the struggle that so many Americans have when it comes to the issue of depression or bipolar disorder. Approximately one in every 10 Americans at some point in their life will be diagnosed with this illness. and approximately 3 in 100 will be diagnosed with bipolar disorder. So this is something where so many people these days have been either personally affected by one of these mental illnesses, or they have a friend or a loved one who has. It's also important, I think, as a takeaway message, to know at the end of the day what we're dealing with here is really biological illnesses. And just as we wouldn't blame someone who's diagnosed with cancer or with heart problems, we wouldn't place blame on them and say that they're weak per se by any means, it should be the same thing when it comes to something like depression or bipolar disorder. There's certainly a great deal of stigma there. And seeing that one of our heroes, one of our icons here in the States, like Robin Williams, can be suffering from such an illness, I think it's something where it really puts a loving, friendly, and kind face on an illness that impacts so many of us.
Dr. Jay Singh is a Washington, D.C.-based expert on suicide. Also, he's with the Yale School of Medicine, specializing in the treatment of depression and bipolar disorder. During his decades-long career in television and movies, Robin Williams entertained fans of all ages. He won acclaim for numerous films, including Mrs. Doubtfire, Good Morning Vietnam, and Good Will Hunting, which earned him the Academy Award for Best Supporting Actor in 1998. Reporters asked him if Good Will Hunting was the movie of all of his work for which he would have preferred to win the Oscar.
Oh, yes, this one, yes. Uh-huh. The other ones were just foreplay. This is wild night. It's insane. I'm still like this. I was in there taking photos. I was like, hey, nice to be here. I have to change pants, but you'll understand that later. No, it is. It's extraordinary. I'm very proud.
He was born in Chicago back in 1951 and was a stand-up comedian when he made his television debut in the late 1970s, playing an alien in the situation comedy Mork and Mindy. Also acted on Broadway and continued performing stand-up comedy even after becoming a movie star, delighting audiences with that rapid-fire improvisational routines. Well, the late actor's wife, Susan Schneider, released a statement saying, "As he is remembered, it is our hope that the focus will not be on Robin's death, but on the countless moments of joy and laughter he gave to millions." In addition to his wife, Williams is survived by his 3 adult children. American actress, a legendary actress, Lauren Bacall, the one-time model who became an overnight film star working opposite her eventual husband, Humphrey Bogart, has died. She was 89 years old. Bacall captivated audiences from the moment she burst into films in the 1940s. She was just 20 years old when she played opposite Bogart in the film To Have and Have Not.
You know, Steve, you're not very hard to figure. Only at times. Sometimes I know exactly what you're going to say. Most of the time. The other times, you're just a stinker.
What'd you do that for?
Been wondering whether I'd like it.
What's the decision?
I don't know yet. It's even better when you help. Sure you won't change your mind about this?
Uh-huh.
This belongs to me and so do my lips. I don't see any difference.
Oh, I do.
Okay. You know you don't have to act with me, Steve. You don't have to say anything and you don't have to do anything. Not a thing. Oh, maybe just whistle. You know how to whistle, don't you, Steve? You just put your lips together and blow.
Amazing. You should go online and look up that part from To Have and Have Not, Lauren Bacall, Humphrey Bogart. Bacall's family said she died after a massive stroke at her New York City home. That happened Tuesday morning. In 1999, the American Film Institute named Bacall 20th on its list of the top 25 actresses of all times. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. It's always good to have you with us. A reminder, if you find yourself on Twitter at any time, you can find me there in that conversation about what's going on around the world. I can be found at VOA Norman. Also, the latest world news is coming up shortly. Hope you'll stay tuned. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Jimmy Cook, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Wednesday.
This is Today in History. On this day in 1521, the remnants of the Aztec army, weakened by European diseases and a lack of supplies, surrendered to Japanese conquistador Hernando Cortes. The capitulation brought the Aztec Empire, located in present-day Mexico, to an end and gave Cortes control over a vast territory that became known as New Spain. On this day in 1792, King Louis XVI of France, already in custody, was formally arrested by the rebel National Tribunal and declared an enemy of the people. On this date in 1899, movie maker Alfred Hitchcock was born in London. Hitchcock's innovative directing techniques and mastery of suspense made him one of the most popular filmmakers of the 20th century. He began his film directing career in Britain, but received international acclaim for his Hollywood productions with such titles as Suspicion, Dial M for Murder, North by Northwest, and The Birds. Hitchcock died in 1980. In 1954, on this date, Radio Pakistan broadcast the national anthem of Pakistan for the very first time. In 1961, communist-ruled East Germany closed the border and built a wall between East and West Berlin to halt the exodus of its people to the West. The Berlin Wall became a symbol of repression by communist regimes during the Cold War. In 1964, murderers Peter Allen and Gwen Evans were hanged, becoming the last people executed in the United Kingdom. That's it for today. I'm Dave DeForest with Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The first challenge is to grow African democracy, U.S. Permanent Representative to the United Nations Ambassador Samantha Power said recently as she laid out two challenges to the young Africans gathered at the Young African Leaders Initiative in Washington, D.C. Democracy is about more than just holding an occasional election, Ambassador Power said. Democracy means government that respects the will and the rights of its people, like the right to speak one's mind without fear or the right to gather with others to share ideas. Democracy means building the capable, independent institutions that can help defend human rights when they are threatened, such as impartial courts, accountable police forces, and strong parliaments. In 1990, there were only four electoral democracies in sub-Saharan Africa. Today, there are 19. The second challenge, Ambassador Power noted, was to improve Africa's stability and security. Africa, she said, is also in the midst of phenomenal economic growth, adding that more needs to be done to ensure equal access to the expanding opportunities that growth offers. One major impediment to inclusive growth is conflict. To address the problems of conflicts and groups like Boko Haram and Al-Shabaab that are terrorizing civilians across the region, Ambassador Power argued that Africa needs better trained, better equipped, and more professional military and police forces. I make this argument as a longtime human rights advocate, Ambassador Power said, because it is hard to imagine lasting peace without rights-respecting, professional security and police forces being part of the solution. History hinges on the women and men who faced down their deepest doubts in those lonely places and walked out of them more determined than ever, Ambassador said, as she urged the young African leaders to tackle the two challenges facing Africa. That is how change is made. You are going to go out there and make it.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.